or good evening from whatever time zone you're listening from, and whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm Karen Tate, and you were listening to Sacred Way by Abigail Spinner McBride. Now, we are on today at a different day and a different time to accommodate our guest, Patricia Corey, who is the author of Where Pharaohs Dwell, One Mystic's Journey Through the Gates of Immortality. And as I wait for her to call in, she's a little bit late. Let me tell you what led up to this interview with her. Well, I had personally been lamenting our loss of the woman many of us know as Om Seti. The name she was born with, she was a British woman, was Dorothy Eady. And she has a very interesting story that's well documented in a wonderful book by the author Jonathan Cott, K-O-T-T. I don't know if it's still in print, but I would certainly recommend you look for it. I couldn't put it down, quite frankly. And Dorothy Eady, a.k.a. Om Seti, was a woman of our time. She only passed away in the 80s. There were PBS documentaries about her. Well, she believed that she had actually lived an ancient life in Egypt. And I see that Patricia is on the line there, and I'm going to get to her in just a minute. But getting back to Dorothy Eady, Seti, who inspired this interview with Patricia, she had an accident, and I believe she fell and she hit her head. And when she recovered from that, she realized she had all of these memories of ancient Egypt. Well, you know, at first blush, one might think, you know, am I going to believe this? Well, these were such powerful memories for her that she was singularly focused on getting herself from England to Egypt, where she spent her entire life. She married an Egyptian man and had a son, and she ended up working for the Egyptian Antiquities Department, eventually living in Abydos, where she spent her adult life honoring the ancient gods, and she also passed away in Abydos. And what was remarkable about Seti is that she had the respect of all the archaeologists of her time. She knew things that she couldn't possibly have known without firsthand knowledge. She helped them find a garden, for instance, that was buried under the sand, and no one really knew where it was, but she knew exactly where it was, and when they dug where she told them to dig, lo and behold, they found the the remains of this ancient fountain and garden area. So anyway, if you've never heard of Om Seti before, a remarkable woman. I believe I said she passed away in the 80s, a very old woman, but died happy and content that she had lived out her life in ancient Egypt. And she believed that the pharaoh that she was connected to in her life in ancient Egypt, they had an affair, that he actually came to her in her dreams through a means of, astral projection. Well, and I was just about to say hello to Patricia, but it seems her call has dropped out. But I'm going to, I guess, continue to talk until she calls back. Anyway, what I'd like to tell you about Patricia is her book, Where Pharaohs Dwell. She had a similar story, and I hope she gets back to us. Maybe she is having a connection problem. I believe she's calling on Skype. Here she is. Let me see if I can connect with her now. Patricia, is that you? Patricia, is can you hear me?
Hi, I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Because your call dropped out and then it came back, and I was speaking to you, and you didn't seem to be hearing me. So I want to thank you for calling in from Europe to discuss your book, Where Pharaohs Dwell.
This is not Patricia.
Oh, it isn't Patricia. Okay,
no.
So that's why when I said Patricia, you didn't answer. Well, this is odd. Patricia and I emailed yesterday. Thank you, caller. Patricia and I emailed yesterday, and she was supposed to call in. Maybe there's a little bit of a time glitch, so I will continue with my train of thought in hopes that she will be calling back in just a moment. Otherwise, we'll have to reschedule. But let me make a few announcements that I would have normally made before we started our chat. If you're in the Southern California area, I want to make sure you know about Sacred Sundays. They've started at a store called The Green Man in North Hollywood. We had been on hiatus for a while, but we're back now, and we're doing these sacred rituals the fourth Sunday of every month. The next service is September 25th, this Sunday, as a matter of fact. It's a very eclectic service, honoring the divine feminine and sacred masculine. There's singing and sharing and wisdom telling. It's really a great way to connect with the community and carve out some sacred space for yourself once a month. If you want more information about it, you can go to my website, KarenTate.com. Just go to the Sacred Sundays button, and that will take you to the page where there's a little bit more of a description. I'm one of the sacred feminine priestesses facilitating the service each month, so please come out and say hello. Let's see, the other thing I wanted to mention to you, as long as we're on the subject of my website, and this interview today was supposed to be about ancient Egypt, is, you know, I have a connection with some of the Egyptian goddesses. I was first called to this because of my interest in Isis, and then later my interest in Sekhmet. So there are actually free downloadable meditations on my website. If you go to KarenTate.com and then click on the Goddess Store page, and scroll down the page a bit, and you will see down there there is a sacred journey to the Isis temple. There's also a meditation about getting to know Sekhmet a bit more, and some other little bit more generic guided meditations that you can download, and they are there for no charge. I am at a loss, listeners, as to why Patricia is not calling in. I know there's a time difference where she is and here. That's why we're doing this at noon instead of our usual Wednesday at 6 o'clock. So she was our only guest today, and I have never had this happen to me in 3 years, quite frankly, that the guest didn't show up. But what I promise I will do is, if there was a good reason for this, we will try to reschedule Patricia Corey and talk about her book, Where Pharaohs Dwell, because it seems like she is the modern-day Amseti. You know, maybe she's in the middle of a delicious dream. But if you look up her book, you will see that she's led quite an interesting life. She takes people back in her book through her channeled work as a scribe to the speakers of the Syrian High Council, and she focuses on her past life experiences in ancient Egypt. Let me just see if this is her calling in. Just a moment. Patricia, is that you?
That's me.
Oh, I was just about to give up on you.
I've been having a hard time getting through to you for some reason. I am calling from Italy, so maybe.
Okay. All right. Well, wonderful. I was. I'm so glad you called. I was like 30 seconds from saying goodbye to my listeners who had tuned in, and that we were going to reschedule.
I'm sorry, listeners. Here I am.
Okay, good, good, good. Okay, well, here she is, listeners, and calling us from Italy, as she says. I was just in the process, so you'll know, bring you up to date on what we've been chatting about here, or I've been chatting about to my listeners. I was telling them about Amsetti, or do you know Amsetti, or about Amsetti, Patricia?
Oh, yes, I know a lot about Amsetti, as discussed in the book.
Okay. Well, you know, that's how I found you. I was lamenting Amsetti's passing, and then I stumbled across you, and I thought, this woman has quite a similar story. Why don't you tell us a bit about that? You had through trauma, you started to recall past lives. You were buried alive, I believe?
Yeah, well, basically, many years ago, I had a past life regression, and it was my first, and I couldn't believe that I was experiencing what I was experiencing, because I thought I was not going into or not leaving my waking consciousness, and yet I found myself very rapidly unable to move. So I was hearing the hypnotist or the regressionist voice, and I was spinning on a wheel, and I was uncomfortable, so I wanted to get out, and I couldn't move at all, and I realized I was in, shall we say. And he took me to, he guided me to look at, when the wheel stopped, to tell him what I saw, and I saw a mine shaft, which then turned into an Egyptian, entrance to an Egyptian tomb. And it kept going back and forth in the mines between a shaft and a tomb. And he invited me to go in and look at it. And within a very short time, I found myself reliving being buried alive in a past life in Egypt in this tomb, and living the sound of the stone wall closing me in and slowly dying. And in fact, I remember him saying, he almost lost me. That was pretty
intense.
So
you were in the present time. You almost passed away during this regression.
Well, sure, because when you work, and I've been a healer for 30 years, and when you work with different levels of consciousness, it is not unthinkable that if you can't get a person back from that state, in that level of consciousness, that in the reality consciousness is, if we can call this reality, they may simply go.
I see. Okay, I didn't realize that. So what was happening there in Egypt? I mean, I believe I've read that sometimes the pharaohs had their servants buried with them. Was that the case? Was that what was happening to you?
Well, I'd hate to give the whole book away. It kind of has a surprise ending to it, shall we say.
Okay,
but basically,
well, just tell us what you can.
That led me to a number of adventures into Egypt, and every time I went, I discovered more and more links that were proof, that were, let's say, tangible evidence of a path I was following to rediscover this lifetime. Because during the regression, he asked me who I was, and I said Hatshepsut. And he wrote that down. And then I was calling out at the time of the dying scene in this horrible past life state. I was calling out, Matkara, 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 why do you abandon me? And I found out that Queen Hatshepsut, at the time, wasn't very popular. I couldn't find information on her later, but the Queen Hatshepsut, was her pharaonic name was Matkara, and nobody knew that. Nobody could give me that information in Egypt. I finally found it in a book, and I said, "Wait a minute, my name was Hatshepsut, and the pharaonic name was Matkara." So I realized that this was so precise, that was where my path would take me, to the Queen Hatshepsut and her story. And it turns out that I was in her court. And the book describes why I was murdered and what I knew and why I was murdered.
Intriguing, especially when you think about there's so much, her story is provocative. You know, was she, did she really have an affair with her builder and, that whole story there, how she had to pretend to be a male and she wore the pharaonic beard and all of that. So, were your details of that life very clear or were they just sort of vague snippets?
Well, as I pursued this experience, I relived a lot of things. And one of the big moments was Abydos, where Om Seti had gone to live. So I'd love to talk about that for a minute.
Go right ahead.
Okay, Om Seti, have you already discussed this with the audience?
Well, I mentioned who she was. She was Dorothy Edie, and she had fallen and I believe hit her head, and then she started, having remembrances of a past life, and that she spent her adult life, honoring the ancient gods in Abydos. But that was it for the most part.
Okay. Well, there's a little bit more to the story than that. As a young girl, Dorothy, I think when she was 14 years old, she was in a very strict Christian family in England, and she started having visitations from a ghost, and he described himself as being the Pharaoh Seti, Seti I. And these visits got so provocative that she actually had experiences of having a sexual encounter with ghosts. It got so intense that she told her parents about it, and they said that she had mind of a demon or whatever. But she was so compelled by this experience because he told her they had been lovers in the past, and his soul was out of harmony because of the disgrace that they had lived through. To make a long story short, these visits got more and more intense, and finally she went to the museum, I think the British Museum, where she started to work in the section of the Egypt sector, and found that she knew a lot of the hieroglyphs. To the surprise of the directors of this department in the museum, she was explaining what a lot of the glyphs meant. So finally she was drawn to go to Egypt because her whole life was consumed by this memory of this pharaoh and her love of Egypt. So she went to Egypt. I can't give you the exact time at the moment of when she met an Egyptian guy, got married, and went to work for the Department of Antiquities. Now, this is very rare because a woman at that time, we're talking about 1940 or 45, I believe, working for the Department of an Egyptian Antiquities. She was an oopart in every sense. And she worked for many years in Cairo. But this call of this Pharaoh Seti was incessant. And one day they told her that they needed someone to go down to Abydos and do some work there. And she jumped on it because that's where Pharaoh Seti had built his temple to the gods. So she went to Abydos, and there she walked the temple every day. She reconstructed a lot of the temple. She was able to tell the archaeologist, no, don't dig there, dig there. And then they would go in and dig and find exactly what she told them would be there. She was extremely clairvoyant. So she was beloved. At first she was the people were very suspicious of this blonde foreigner coming and sitting in living in a mud hut like them in the middle of the desert. But they grew to love her because she was truly the guardian of the temple. And she relived the experience of having been a virginal maiden, or a goddess, sorry, priestess, in this temple. And Pharaoh Seti made love to her. He seduced her. And this banished her from eternity. And that is why these two souls were so tormented. But he was in love with her and she was in love with him. So she went back to Abydos to find her pharaoh and died there.
And I believe from reading Jonathan Cott's book about Amseti, titled In Search of Amseti, she had sort of an uneasy, at times, relationship with the locals. Some of them feared her. They thought she was a witch. Others went to her for healing. And I believe she used, correct me if I'm wrong, because I read this a long time ago, but some of the waters that come up there from the Osirian, that's the old temple that's kind of behind the newer temple there. Say again, please, couldn't hear you.
It's beneath and behind.
Beneath and behind. And I remember she tells of she stumbled or something in that temple and she thought maybe she had found a secret room, but then she could never find it again. Does that ring a bell?
Yes, it does, because I have had some pretty interesting experiences in this temple. And I'm convinced that the temple opens up to another dimension. And it appears that it opens up occasionally and it closes back down. And I've had this experience. And this is described in my book, Where Pharaohs Dwell, where I talk about how I'm in the temple, because I spent many, many days there. I used to go there, and like Amseti, and I spent weeks there at a time. In fact, I wrote part of the book there. So I would go into the temple in the morning, and I had Amir, who was my soul brother there, guardian of the temple now, and he knew Amseti. And he would give me my morning tea and then arrange so that I could be alone in the temple as much as possible. And I would go in and meditate in these different chambers. One morning I went into one of the chambers, and I saw the most breathtaking fresco of Pharaoh Seti holding the goddess Maat in his hand. Maat is the goddess who balances the scales for the soul when they go to the afterlife. And so he had Maat in his hand, and Maat had a smaller Maat in hers. This smaller one had yet another Maat, and yet another and another. And it was so breathtakingly beautiful that I sat there and stared at it for hours, which is really not my style. I'm not the kind of person that goes to a museum and just looks at a painting or a statue for 5 hours, because I don't have that kind of time. But I just sat there and just gazed at this, and I remember just kind of going out of my body, just loving, imagining what that meant. The message was the goddess holding a smaller, smaller, smaller version of the goddess. And since I channel sixth-dimensional beings, I thought, wow, that is as if they're saying that this is Maat to the sixth dimension. Well, when I went back to my friend's house where I was staying, I told him about this appearance of this carving, and he said, where did you see this? And I told him, and he said, I saw this once, and I cannot find it again. I'm going crazy. I said, well, I just sat all day with it. And he said, where? I saw it in the Hypo Hall, which would be the outer hall of the temple. I said, no, it's in the second chamber. So we go back, and it's not there. I go, look, I know I saw this in this chamber. It's not there. And I went berserk. Excuse me, I have spent the entire morning with this incredible carving. And I went through the whole temple all over again. It's a pretty ornate temple to go through, looking for it, and it was gone. After that, I spoke to locals, I spoke to the guard, I spoke to other people that were coming to visit the temple and other people in the know. There are a few foreigners, expats, living in Abydos, and almost all of them said, I saw it once, and I've never seen it again. So I say, well, I guess the temple is shifting into another dimension, and for some reason we are able to see that particular design for a flash, and then it shuts back down as if it's a teaser or a message of what is in that higher space. So
well,
I think that's what happened to him.
When she stumbled upon that room that, and then could never find it again.
Yeah.
So she stumbled onto like a portal to maybe another dimension or something.
Yeah, that's what I think. Because surely they would have found it again. I mean, all these years, all the digs. I think she just slipped into another dimension.
So, Patricia, and I don't want you to give away too much of your book. Obviously, you know, you want listeners to get the book. But you said you've unraveled a lot of the origins of the ancient Egyptians, why they're obsessed with resurrection of the soul, even earlier cultures such as Atlantis and stuff like that. What is it you feel you want to share with listeners today? What do we have wrong about Egypt or their timeline? I mean, one thing I want to ask you specifically, and then I'll let you answer. As you know, I've always felt like the Sphinx was not really originally carved that way. I know there's the geologist who says it's really probably 10,000 years old and it's water erosion and all of that. And I've just intuitively felt like that head was originally a lion's head. And I'm just throwing that out there to you. But does that resonate at all? And, you know, what is it, can you tell us about Egypt that is misunderstood today?
Well, that would take a little bit more than 20 or so minutes, but basically I'd like to address the question of the Sphinx, and that is that without a doubt, that head that is on it now is not the original head. There are people who say that it was originally designed like Anubis, the god of the underworld, which is a dog, and that the haunches and the position of the Sphinx represent the body posture of a dog rather than a lion.
Okay.
But I don't resonate with that. I truly believe that it is, like you said, a depiction of a cat. Cats were very important in Egyptian civilization and corresponds to the Sekhmet, the whole family line of gods and goddesses that were cat people, as the goddess Sekhmet, and as the cat Bas, also a god. So I think that, yes, it was a feline creature or a depiction of a feline being. And I'll go so far as to say that I also believe that the Great Sphinx is one of the, perhaps the most important Syrian portal on the earth. Now, in Sirius, we have a number of feline allusions to civilizations in the Sirian star system, and one person who talks about this wonderfully is Mary Hope in her book, The Peshats, which I recommend people read, which talks about cat people who have come from Sirius.
I think Yeah,
it's a wonderful
and she
book.
Also has another one, The Lion and the Crystal People, I believe.
Exactly. So that's what I think. I think that it's a Syrian portal and that it represents the civilization of Syrians who probably also did the one that's on the moon. On Mars.
Okay. So, you know, I was in a class once where they were teaching us to do what they called aspecting, and basically it was channeling. You were inviting a goddess to enter through you and talk. And one of the women there who knew nothing about Sekhmet prior, she wasn't into the Egyptian tradition, channeled Sekhmet. And much to her surprise, she didn't even expect to be able to do this, and here she's channeling a goddess she knew nothing about, and Sekhmet told her that she was from the stars. Is that what you're talking about here, the Syrian connection? Because I will admit, I have not read your Syrian books. I don't know a lot about that. But I've read the Murray Hope books.
Yes. Well, I hope you'll read my books as well. And but I, yes, I do believe that Sekhmet is an effigy that has a direct relationship to the Syrian. There's a distinctive connection between Syria, Atlantis, and Egypt. And Sekhmet is a prominent goddess in Egypt. She's described as the goddess of war and to be the dark side of the goddess Hathor. But I don't interpret her that way. I interpret her as the power and the will, the fiery will. She is quite powerful. And I do believe that there's a connection to Sirius with Sekhmet. And therefore, when I see these cat-like effigies in Egypt, I immediately make the connection to Sirius. And Murray Hope confirms that in her wonderful books. Lion and Crystal People is a good book as well, where she talks about these beings coming from Sirius.
So do you think Isis, Sekhmet, do you think they were ETs, or do you think they were, you know, ETs from another planet, or do you think they were, humans from a long time ago that walked the earth? Or what else? What else might they have been?
That's a very good question, and it's up to the interpretation of each one of us as we resonate to these archetypal forces. For me, I think there's no question that this Earth has been guided by extraterrestrials for many, many civilizations, many thousands and thousands of years, and that there have been benevolent ET and powerful ET forces who have guided civilization at certain peak moments on the planet. Certainly Atlantis is one, and certainly Egypt is another. And we need to imagine now, according to the information I have, Atlantis was 100,000 years of civilizations ebbing and flowing. That's a lot of time. And according to Hakim, who unfortunately is no longer on this plane, who was the indigenous wisdom keeper of the Kanishan wisdom in Egypt, he says, and I agree with him, that the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx and the Osirian that you mentioned in Abydos are actually not 10,000 years old, not 4,000 years old, not 2,000 years old as they are said to be by the modern archaeologists, but more like 50,000 years old.
And, that really blows my mind, because I'm thinking about, have they ever been carbon dated? Have they just not done that because, you know, we're just reading the ancient Egyptian timeline?
I don't know how carbon dating works, but apparently it can't go back that far.
Okay.
Robert Schulk, who is the man who discussed the water flow on the Sphinx, dates it back to around 11,500 due to the fact that that's when there would have been water, intense water, in that location. But Hakim, who was truly the wisdom keeper of the oral tradition of tribes in this region of Africa for so many millenniums, says it is absolutely, without question, far, far, far older than anyone can imagine. For example, the Great Pyramid, the archaeologists say, if you look at all these other pyramids and how they never held up, and there are a number of pyramids like the Red Pyramid, the Bent Pyramid, mm-hmm. Dasher, etc., that are misshapen or falling apart or whatever. And the claim that they make is they were all testing to be able to make this great pyramid for the Pharaoh Cheops, which is ludicrous because you can't get from where they were to this monumental perfection of design. So Hakeem and I, who I've shared many, many an evening with talking, discussed the fact that the Great Pyramid came way before those other failed pyramids, and that the greatness of the civilization was way before that timeline, so that other epochs of Egyptian history tried to emulate the Great Pyramid. In other words, they came after the Great Pyramid trying to copy it, not before, mm-hmm. trying to perfection, to reach perfection to be able to build it.
Okay.
And that the idea that it was built for a pharaoh is utterly ludicrous, because there's never been found anything that would indicate that it was a burial site.
So what do you think the purpose of the pyramids were? Is, or, not sure which tense to use.
Well, I love the work of Christopher Dunn, who wrote a book called The Giza Power Plant, which I recommend if people are interested in this subject, they should read. And he elaborates how the Great Pyramid was designed to be a power station to activate the Earth's nervous system, the Earth grid lines, to draw that power up into the pyramid and then utilize it to activate other key points in the area, and even to create a force like energy to be utilized by the local people to energize, to grind their grain, etc. And that's an interesting hypothesis. For me, I think it is a lock-on point for consciousness from all other civilizations, that this is sort of an epicentral, very powerful energy spot on the planet. In fact, as you know, the Great Pyramid is visible from space.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
When I bring people in, in fact, in November, we're going to be inside on 11-11-11. I conduct ceremony inside the chamber, and each person gets to lie down in the sarcophagus. And the experience of being in that sarcophagus is like being in a chariot to the gods. Many, many people experience being catapulted out of their bodies and journeying in some sort of a space-like vacuum. And so I call it the time travel chariot. I think that they also conducted ceremonies there and used that sarcophagus as a vehicle of transportation.
Very interesting. I've actually been to Egypt a couple times, and I laid in that sarcophagus, but I don't have... I'm sure the metaphysical savvy that you do. And I think the circumstances have to be right, too. I mean, I was not there in a ritual. You know, it was very much one of these, they rush you in and they rush you out. So that doesn't work.
Yeah. I can say this. My partner, who is not he's a meat and potatoes guy, he said, I wish I could feel what you feel. I don't understand. So when I brought him to Egypt, we reserved the pyramid, which is very expensive to have private time there. And we were in for 2 hours at 4:00 in the morning. And he had the luxury of lying in the sarcophagus for an hour. And he had his first experience. He had a huge experience. He was transported to another state of mind or another dimension, whoever you want to call it. But the point is that until then, he couldn't even understand what I was talking about.
Right.
And so there he was, completely protected, with me holding the space for him and able to just lie in that sarcophagus and journey. And he did have an amazing, amazing experience as well.
Well, you know, Patricia, normally, you know, when I have guests on the show, we generally, you know, have some sort of discussion beforehand, you know, where, you know, what you want to share with listeners, you know, where we're going to talk, you know, where we're going to have the conversation flow. And you and I didn't really get a chance to do that. So, you know, I don't want to ask you to talk about things you don't want to talk about, but I'm not sure what, you know, what it is you want my listeners to know. So I'm going to ask you to guide me a little bit rather than the other way around. You know, what is it do you want to make sure listeners understand about the goddesses or Egypt or Atlantis? You know, what's the important points that you wanted to bring?
You asked me a question earlier. I got sidetracked, and that was to discuss the Egyptian preoccupation with resurrection. And since we are also so focused on ascension at this time, I would like to draw some parallels to this situation, this concept. Throughout civilization, mankind or humankind has been in touch with their own deity within and their immortality, and then lost touch. I believe that we have cycles of reality where, and society, where we go from being extremely spiritual and deeply connected to Source, and then descend into a material consciousness as we find a lot of the planet Earth is now. And this duality is part of the nature of being in the third dimension, and certainly reflects what we've experienced. If you're over 20, certainly you've seen how in the last 10 years, 15 years, there has been a splitting of human consciousness to people who are seeking a spiritual understanding of reality in their lives, and then the extreme material, almost debauchery, where all that matters is sex and rocks and roll and every gadget available and the whole nine yards of material gratification. Well, the Egyptians and many other cultures even today, or at least, let's say, even 10 years ago, were dedicated, their whole lives were about death. They knew that death was a passage into another state of being, and that all that mattered in the lifetime was preparation for that moment. So this is why the pharaohs, who of course were the wealth and the power, built themselves these extraordinary tombs with all these tunnels and art and every kind of supplies, food. And yes, they actually brought their servants in and killed them or let them suffocate so that in the afterlife they would wake up and serve them in the afterlife. So they didn't quite, in my opinion, really understand what the afterlife is about, or the, say, moving into another state of consciousness. But at any rate, they were dedicated to that passage. And this is indicative of many societies and many civilizations on our planet now. If you look at the Eastern civilizations, you look at the Tibetans, who the lamas sit down when it's their time to pass. They sit down in a room and quietly walk out of their bodies. Do you know about this?
No.
Many lamas are reported to leave footprints. They go into a room to pass. They are asked not to be disturbed until a certain time has passed, I think 30 days or 30 moons. And then when the monks go in to find them, sometimes they actually find footprints in the dust, indicating the direction that the soul has headed and where they should look for the reincarnation of this lama. This was the case in a number of things that I've read about some of the more highly evolved lamas in the Tibetan civilization. And there again, the consciousness is about preparing for that passage with joy and anticipation. But in our Western societies, death is scary, it's horrible, it's dark, it's pain and suffering, and we don't ever want to talk about it. Right?
Right.
So what's happening now is with the consciousness evolving about ascension, what really is going to happen as we shift into this new time, this new epoch of awakening on this planet, I feel that we are again returning to that wonder and that questioning of our immortality. And this is fabulous, because when you understand that you are an immortal being, you lose all fear. All fear of life, all fear of terrorists, all fear of poverty, it all goes, because you know, if you get the fact that you're immortal, that this is school and you're just passing through.
So by immortal, you're talking about our soul or our consciousness is immortal, not,
yes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, talking about preserving the body for thousands of years. It's not necessary. We don't need to do that. But the soul is immortal.
Okay.
In other words, you go through a tube, you're a spark of light on some other dimension, some other level, you're a spark, being of light. You decide to descend into the third dimension to experience school for something you need
here.
To learn. Yeah, right, exactly. To enhance your soul consciousness, your I am consciousness. You go through the tunnel of the third dimensional reality or life on earth in your body, and you come out the other side and you're back in the light. You go, wow, all right, let's go on to the next project. This is how I perceive reality.
So along with what you just described, do you believe that we are reincarnated to keep coming back to work on our garbage so that we, you know, can become higher levels of beings with every incarnation?
Yes, although I don't think necessarily we come back just to work on our garbage, because I think that we also come back to be given gifts celebrating our achievements in each life. I tend to go for the positive side
right.
of things. And I think we make mistakes, or not mistakes, but we create obstructions for ourselves, blocking our achievements of climbing higher on the path to light. And so we come back and work on that issue until we get it right.
Now, I'm sure you've been asked this many times, but do you have any insights about, we're coming on 2012 and all of the different swirling ideas about what that is? You obviously must think 11-11-11 is significant, too. I've heard people say that, you know, we're going to start to see the shift happening at the end of October of this year. I mean, there's just so much out there, you know, and I'm wondering
yes.
if it's going to end up being like Y2K. You remember it was just a
mm-hmm.
bunch of hooey that turned out to be nothing. But personally, you know, I hope we all do wake up evolved, after a certain date, but and probably not realistic. But what do you think is really ahead in the next year or two for us? I mean, is there something that's going to happen in your opinion?
Yeah, I think that we're already in 2012 and that it's not a finite date. I agree with you completely. In fact, I've used that analogy that we heard people doing the end-of-the-world scenario for YK, and then they woke up and they were sitting on some serious stock of lima beans and things they had to
eat
for years. So I believe that 2012, December 21st, 2012, is a significant date for many reasons. First of all, there's a whole debate if that is really, in fact, the end of the Mayan calendar or not. A lot of people
mm-hmm.
refute that. John Palamon, for example, refutes that and gives reasons for that. But I think that this is all a lot of mental activity that we don't need to bother ourselves with. What's important is that the nature, the fact that such a date has been chiseled into the consciousness of a huge part of the population of this planet is very significant. That being, when December 21st, 2012 passes and the whole, you know, a meteor doesn't land on the earth or whatever the apocalyptic scenario is, and we wake up on December 22nd of that year, an entire mass of, let's say, I would think at least two-thirds of the population are worried about 2012 or contemplating what's going to happen. So all of that, fear, doubt, anxiety, anticipation, it's all going to go over. Right?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Or so, it's going to be a big letdown. I mean, it could be a big disappointment.
Well, it could be a big disappointment for the people that think they're going to ascend automatically off their rooftop, but it's going to be a huge relief because the majority of people are afraid of that date. I believe that the majority of people are afraid of that date and are going to be more afraid by the time it comes because it's huge marketability for the power, for the media, right?
Okay.
Very easy to scare people. It's much more difficult to make people laugh and find peace. So as we get closer and closer to that date, I can just imagine the programming that we're going to receive from the media and the, let's say, the secret media that wants to hold the population in fear. And when that date passes and nothing horrific has happened, there's going to be a huge shift in consciousness by the nature of the fact that how many thousands, how many millions of people are going to sigh a relief, a breath of relief, and say, okay, now what? All of that negative energy and that fear is going to dissipate immediately. And that alone is going to be a huge shift for the planet. For the rest, I think we're already in 2012. I think we're already seeing this shift. Shocking things are happening, dark and light. Amazing things are happening on this planet right now. And we are all feeling it. We're feeling time mutate. We're feeling the earth screaming out. We're witnessing unbelievable technological advancement, some good, some not so good. And we are more and more every day we are experiencing changes within us, changes within our environment. Our world is in complete revolution.
Well, it feels that way. And I think for those of us who want things to change, you know, who want to get away from predator capitalism and oppression and the haves, you know, the haves, you know, having the have-nots by the throat, you know, that whole idea. But, you know, you wonder, you know, you really wonder if, you know, things can really change in our lifetime, you know, enough that we'll say, yeah. Yeah, you know, the humankind did evolve, and I live to see it, you know.
Well, look around you. How I'm not a youngster, and I can remember when there was nothing available, nothing. Back when I was a kid, you couldn't find anything to read about anything esoteric. Very little, let's say that, very little.
Right.
And then
right.
We have the Alice Bailey information, the Theosophist, et cetera. But certainly it was another world then, and people's minds were utterly closed. As a child, I used to talk about extraterrestrials, and people would think I was crazy. and look now.
Right, right.
I would like to say this. I go around the world, I speak around the world, and I remember talking to 10 or 15 people, and now I'm talking to thousands and thousands of people.
Right.
I truly believe, as dark as the dark side is, the light forces are rising and people are waking up. in droves.
Well, it feels that way. You know, it feels that way, and, you know, and I don't want to be a cynic. You know, I mean, I feel like we're sort of teetering on the edge of a knife and potentially it could go either way, and sometimes I really worry about, you know, the people in power with their money and their influence and control over the military, you know, that we could, you know, end up in a corporate, you know, a corporate-controlled globe, I mean, worse than it is now, and, you know, that maybe we fall, you know, fall off the edge of that knife in the wrong direction, you know. I don't want that, of course, but sometimes it feels like the dark has more power than the light.
Never underestimate the power of the human spirit.
Well, they're occupying Washington and next month, and they're occupying Wall Street as we speak for 5 days. And you know,
that's,
and we
right.
Maybe, you know, well, and I do want to get back to this, but I just had a couple people email me a couple questions, and I always try to honor my listeners' questions, Patricia, if you don't mind. These are a little bit cliched questions, but let me throw them out there anyway. How did they build the pyramids, and where was Atlantis? Those are the two questions they want me to ask you.
Okay. I don't want to say I'm an expert on Atlantis, but I have recall of Atlantean lifetimes, so I love to talk about Atlantis. And my awareness, and by the way, I've got a book out called Atlantis Rising, The Struggle of Darkness and Light, so it is described in length in that book, and I would love people to grab a copy of that.
And I want you to make sure you mention your website, too.
Okay, it's SyrianRevelations.net.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, my understanding of Atlantis is that it wasn't an island, and it's been described as in a number of ways of being an island somewhere in the Mediterranean. But Plato described it as being outside the Straits of Hercules, the Pillars of Hercules, which corresponds to the Straits of Gibraltar.
Mm-hmm.
Straits of Gibraltar are at the end of the European continent, and right beyond, past that is the North Atlantic Ocean. So the Straits of Gibraltar are between the north of Africa and Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now,
right.
So west of that, in the North Atlantic Ocean, I believe there was a continent, Atlantis was a continent, that reached from as far north as almost Iceland all the way down to Southern America, and of course that will explain why there would be signs of a civilization that far up and also as low down as the Bahamas and Bimini. There have been different discoveries there. And also, just recently, off of the Straits of Gibraltar, near the Azores Island, where I spend a lot of time, they've seen by satellite a whole sort of rectangular construction in the ocean that clearly looks man-made in the deep of the ocean. So they're potentially interested in finding out what's down there. But I believe that Atlantis existed as a huge continent. And that would kind of explain why the Egyptians have pyramids, the Mexicans have pyramids. Instead of having to traverse this huge ocean, how about if they just had small bodies of water to cross because the Atlantean continent was in the middle?
Right.
So that is my belief, that it was a continent of huge proportions that stretched down that body of water.
Okay.
As for the Great Pyramid, how it was built, I'm not sure. I can't hypothesize on it because I can only tell you what my gut level instinct is. And my gut level on this is that the stones were lifted into position by the use of sound, finding resonance. A number of priests, or let's say highly attuned people,
who understood the mysticism of such an event and such of a creation were able to find resonance with the soul note or the sound of the stone itself, and with some methodology that we don't remember, were able to turn off the gravity, let's say, and simply lift it up. There's no other explanation. You cannot possibly believe that slaves dragged the stones up to that top of that pyramid, and
right.
that they were able to place them so close to each other that not even a slip of paper can get through.
Well, not only that, but I mean, you know, we have experts in construction that say, you know, we couldn't do today with all our technology what they did. You know,
that's right.
That it would be impossible. So there has to be something we just don't remember,
yes.
or some technology that we, you know, just no longer have.
Or that we might have, but it hasn't been shared with us yet.
Right, right. Well, you know, Patricia, a lot of my listeners, you know, they're pretty eclectic, and some of them, you know, the show is Voices of the Sacred Feminine, so, you know, here we talk about everything about, quote, goddess, from whether goddess is a real deity to just the archetype to the ideals of what maybe goddess spirituality are. And we sort of touched on it a little bit, but is there anything else you could say to listeners in terms of, you know, do you believe the goddesses or deities in the heaven that, you know, are somebody that you pray to help you in your life? Or do you think that, you know, it's something totally different?
Boy, you do ask good questions.
Just the important ones.
I think that goddess energy is archetypal energy, and that we can call upon the archetypal force of that power and energy to be utilized through us. Not necessarily to call the goddess into us and channel the goddess, but to by focusing, the mere focusing on that archetype empowers us as goddesses that we are to be able to manifest in the three-dimensional realm that force that is brought through that archetypal symbol. As in the case of Sekhmet, who is my goddess personified.
Me too.
Sekhmet is something else. And have you been in her chamber?
Yes, I have, and I'll say something I've never said on the radio show before. I've actually created a sanctuary for her where I have a larger-than-life seated statue of her as well.
That's wonderful.
Yeah,
well,
I believe.
I think that she is the most alive icon, goddess icon in the world. She sits in this little chamber off of the temple grounds, Karnak Temple, and you wouldn't even know about her if you weren't in a spiritual group or if you hadn't read about it. You wouldn't ever know about this chamber because it's off the ground, off the back of the temple, down a dusty path, and it looks very nondescript. But she sits in that temple in the dark. And the only light that comes in is a little slit in the roof that hits her eyes at an oblique angle. And when that light hits her eyes, they fire up, and she's alive. And I have brought, at least 10 groups to Egypt and brought people into the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx and had ceremonies that have been breathtaking. But inevitably, most of the people are most moved when they experience Sekhmet because
mm-hmm.
they say, they walk around that door and they walk in and here is this goddess in her darkness with just that light smashing into her eyes and the fire coming out of those eyes. And many people drop to their knees and say, oh, goddess, the power is immense. And she represents the fiery will, the force. And other goddesses, archetypal goddesses, Isis, Hathor, they are the epitome of love and even the maternal force of Hathor is immense. But for me, nothing is like Sekhmet. She's my god.
Well, I have to agree with you. I mean, I was called to goddess spirituality through Isis, but then as I grew up, so to speak, I mean, I believe Isis is there like the mother, but it's like Sekhmet is walking you through life to sort of steal you and help you become the person you need to be, whether that sometimes that's through trials of fire. It's not always easy. You know, I tend to call that the dark goddess energy. You know, not that dark is negative, but you know, is a distinction between, you know, the things in life that are easier that don't really impact us as much and help us reach our fulfillment. If you follow, you know, what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've actually taken groups to Egypt myself, and we've had wonderful experiences in that chamber with Sekhmet. And I find it interesting that there's not much written about Sekhmet. And as a feminist, who studies feminist theology, I can't help but think, and tell me if you agree or disagree, that the power of Sekhmet, I know in ancient times, you know, they saw her as the bringer of plagues, the warrior goddess. I mean, I think that's only, you know, maybe a small aspect, maybe even a distorted aspect of who she was. I wonder if the fact that we don't know more about her, you know, in written record has to do with the fact that just as goddesses were thwarted and women's power was thwarted, it's almost as if her true nature and her true power were, you know, was hidden. You know, maybe it was in a sense a strategy to thwart female power. Any thoughts on that, or is that just, you know, feminist cynicism?
No, I don't think it is. I agree with you wholeheartedly that definitely there is throughout the Egyptian pantheon of experience, there's always been this male dominance. That's why Hatshepsut is such an exciting character to investigate, because she said, I don't have to be a male. I am the bloodline, and I have the power, and I'll put on the beard if it'll make you comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Hatshepsut was probably one of the first feminists on the planet.
Mm.
But Sekhmet has been misunderstood, I think, as well as what you said. I also think that because she was relegated to the dark side and the destructive force and rage and all of these emotions depicted it through her, she was someone to be feared, not revered.
Mm-hmm.
So revered in fear, but not revered, because very few women, even today, are really in their power.
Right, right.
So to look at Goddess Sekhmet as the icon of the fiery will, the beauty of power, the sense of feminine power that is not destructive, would have empowered all the women.
Right. Yeah, and that's not exactly what the strategy of patriarchy is, quite the opposite.
Definitely not. So she was depicted as this dark warrior, revenge, and you know, the ancient Egyptians were very paranoid. They were superstitious. They played with the dark and light all the time. They did a lot of magic. They did incantations, love potions, the whole bit. They had their demons too. So that kind of got more and more pushed over to that side. And I'm sure that different times in Egyptian civilization, she was revered as well. But it's interesting that at a time when we've had such a huge advance in liberation of female consciousness, Sekhmet has come back into the limelight with so many of us. And there's a great story in the book about how that took place, how Sekhmet activated when I got stuck at the police department trying to negotiate my group here out of going to jail.
Is
did you read that?
The book of Where Pharaohs Dwell?
Yeah. You haven't read
okay.
it?
No, I haven't.
Yeah,
I haven't actually had a chance to read it, but I'm getting ready to go on vacation, and I'm going to take it as my pleasure reading. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to read it before our interview. But, you know, Patricia, I've heard that there are still women in the area of Karnak that under darkness, you know, because obviously it's a Muslim country, under darkness still go and do ritual to her, the indigenous women. And I don't know if there's any basis in fact for that. If you spent time in Abydos and, you know, living there in Egypt for a while, did anything like that ever come to light for you?
No, I have never seen that occur. My experience of women in Egypt is that pretty much they are, well, let me say that in the first days that I went to Cairo, it was still a very open society, and women were very modern. Very few women wore the cover. And it was at once considered the Switzerland of the region, or I think it was called the Paris of the region once, because Cairo is a multicultural city that's full of amazing things. Unfortunately, in the years that have passed, particularly since the incident 9/11, where we have targeted the whole bad energy on the planet as belonging to only Islamic terrorists, the Islamic world, of course, has rebelled against us in a lot of ways. So the women have gone back into that cover as a symbol of their. It's a political symbol as much as it is a religious one.
Okay.
And it's just like, okay, well, if you hate us, then, you know, we're going to stand for our religion. And a lot of women are now back in the chador, or whatever it's called in Egypt. But, no, I have not seen indigenous women practicing, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Okay. You probably know about this, but on the off chance you don't, do you know there's a Sekhmet temple outside Las Vegas?
No.
Well, Genevieve Vaughn, who is she was a benefactress in the goddess community. She, a wealthy woman, she actually went to Egypt and she was on a vacation, and she heard about the power of Sekhmet. And she was having trouble, apparently, for years, was not able to get pregnant. I mean, this is a woman we know. This isn't like this fictional woman that you just, you know, urban legend that you hear about. So she prayed to Sekhmet and said to Sekhmet, if you help me become pregnant, I'll build you a temple. Well, within a few months, she was pregnant with her first daughter. And she kept her promise. She kept her promise, and she built Sekhmet a temple on the Indian reservation outside Las Vegas, about 45 minutes. It's actually in a little city, a tiny little city called Indian Springs. And they built it there because it's not far from where the government was doing nuclear testing, and it was built there in part to help heal the land because she's a healer goddess. And it turned out later on, Genevieve Vaughn went on to have more than one daughter, but she attributes this miracle of sorts to Sekhmet. So there's a small temple out there, and there's a statue of Sekhmet. You can Google it. I wrote about it in my book, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. And there's also a wing in the Rosicrucian Museum in San Jose dedicated to Sekhmet. Down at the end of the hall, there's a huge seated statue of her in black basalt, I assume. You know, bigger than life. If she stood up, she would probably be 9 feet tall.
Yeah, I used to live a few blocks away from the Rosicrucian Museum.
Yeah, and I understand that the curator there, one of the first pieces he ever collected was a tiny seated statue of Sekhmet. So he must have you know, I'd love to talk to him. He might have his own stories and interest in, you know, our lion-headed mother.
Indeed. So, and there's there's quite a collection of Sekhmet effigies in the British Museum as well.
Yes, yes, yes. I'm sorry, say again.
I'm saying when you walk through that part of the museum, you can feel her eyes on you.
Well, and also the Vatican Museum. The Vatican Museum as well has, at least last time we were there, I had many of her statues outside, you know, outside in their garden area, and I just love to see what they have in the vault.
I'm amazed to hear that. I stay clear of the Vatican. It's not my favorite place, and so I have not seen these Sekhmet statues, but if they're there, I might be willing to go there.
Yeah, you should. They actually have a wonderful Egyptian section, and I didn't even see the Sistine Chapel because I was more interested in the Egyptian section, and they have pieces there, you know, statues and artifacts like you don't see anywhere else. So yeah, I definitely say it's worth you know, giving the Vatican your money to go see the statues they've managed to collect. Shall we say over time?
I like that word. Well, I have my own little Sekhmet museum right here in my house. I have 8 effigies of her in my office, so I've got her always with me. And so it's a wonderful connection to you that you have this strong affinity for her too. And you know, I know when you read the book you're going to just chuckle because of the story of Sekhmet coming through and this big brouhaha that involved the police and Luxor, and it's quite a story.
Well, I will definitely look forward to reading it. And, you know, I want to put you in touch with some of the women here locally who are dedicated to her. And some of them are academic women, and they've actually just put out an anthology about Sekhmet. And the name escapes me at the moment, but I'm going to have one of the women on the show. And you know, you may want to know about the book because it's,
definitely,
you know, a lot of contemporary women writing about Sekhmet, you know, just to get some insight as to, I don't know, I guess how other, you know, women and possibly men, I don't know if men are involved or if it's just women, are actually viewing her today and how they embrace her as, I don't know, deity or archetype or certainly ideal. I mean, I think you could probably do all three.
Well, I have to say, to the credit of the men, that the men that come on my programs are tuned right in. I mean, they're there because they're already tuned in. So when they get the Sekhmet experience, they get it just as well as we do.
Right,
and,
right.
Of course, we know that men are awakening to that female, feminine aspect of their own beings. But I do think that the energy of Sekhmet is extremely feminine, and it's about female power.
Mm-hmm. And would you want to give listeners any insights as to how you use, you know, or how you access her her archetypal energy?
The first time I went into Sekhmet in this little chamber, I was with my partner, and he said, "Do you want me to wait outside?" And I said, "No, as long as you're ready for this." So he came in and stood at the back of the chamber, and my power animal is the Black Panther, and I'm very in touch with this spirit, and he's always with me. He's a huge black cat, and he protects me. I'm in so many different situations that his presence is very important in. So I go into the Sekhmet chamber, and I turn around the corner, and the first time you enter that space and you behold Sekhmet in that all her glory, I fell to my knees, and oh, great Sekhmet is all that came out of my mouth. Oh, great Sekhmet, I am humbled before you. and I saw her light, the eyes activate, and I saw her step lift off the ground, and a tunnel or a hallway opened behind her. And so I know that she's a guardian of a portal as well, and that bowing down to her and being in humility is, humility is what matters when you're dealing with Sekhmet. Opening, understanding that the ego is your deterrent, and understanding that power is not ego, will help you lift Sekhmet from her base and find that sacred passageway. And when I was going through that experience, the panther put his paw over my leg. I could see the claws. It was as if to say, okay, we are humble before you, but you don't touch my Patricia. It was truly an amazing experience. And I always tell people this, when you contemplate Sekhmet, know that you are going to be confronting your ego. And everything about this is understanding power, egoless service, power without ego. So that is what I suggest to people.
Okay. Well said. I think I totally agree with you there, too. Well, Patricia, unless I want you to tell listeners about the books you have out there, repeat your website again, and if there's anything I haven't asked you that you want to share with listeners, I guess go ahead and do that now.
Okay, well, I offer the discussion of the Egyptian scenario. My latest book that's just come out is called Before We Leave You, Messages from the Great Whales and the Dolphin Beings. That's just out, and it's really touching people's hearts. It's a message, channeled messages from the whales and dolphins. They're telling us about what's really happening, and it's a wake-up call for the human race to get into action to serve them, to assist them, so that they don't have to go. So I would love people to please check the book out Before We Leave You, available on all the book sites, etc. And then my books are referred to as the Syrian Revelations, but there's no book by that title. So the titles are The Cosmos of Soul, Atlantis Rising, and No More Secrets, No More Lies, form a trilogy of Syrian channeled information that started to come in for me in 1997. There are also many other titles, but I don't want to bore you with all of them. You can check it out on my website, SyrianNations.net, or by going to Amazon and checking out my different books. And the book we've been talking about today, which is Where Pharaohs Dwell.
Okay. Well, Patricia, I am going to honor you and our empowered women out there and our beloved Sekhmet, our feline mother, by closing the show with a wonderful song by a group called Zingaya that's out there in Las Vegas that do a lot of ritual at the Sekhmet Temple. So I'm going to close the show with their Sekhmet Mix song. And if you'd like to stay on and listen, please do. And if you'd like me to connect you with those women who have put that Sekhmet anthology together or continue our conversation about Sekhmet beyond our interview, please feel free. I always like to talk to sisters who are her daughter because I certainly feel that way. So listeners, thank you for tuning in with Patricia and myself on this special day at this special time so that we wouldn't have to ask her to speak to us at 3 a.m. in the morning. And thank you so much, Patricia, for calling in from Italy.
And I'm so sorry about the delay. Thank goodness we connected.
Yes, it all worked out. It all worked out just fine. You see, you had that Sekhmet tenacity. You just kept trying.
Yeah, sure.
All right. All right, and the book was Where Pharaohs Dwell, and I certainly look forward to learning more about your story in the police station with Sekhmet. All right, so here we go. The Sekhmet Mix by Zingaya for the next 5 minutes, listeners. Thank you again for tuning in, and come back to me on Monday at another special day and time. I am going to have another author calling in from Europe. It's Alan Butler, who wrote about all the goddess imagery in Washington, D.C., and I think you'll, and Freemasons and the Sacred Feminine and all of that all wrapped up together. So that'll be another interesting conversation, but it's not at the usual time, Monday at 6 p.m. Pacific. So here, Sekhmet Mix by Zingaya.
Desert, heart, fire.
Sahu.